From the headquarters of Swinnerton, this is the Modern Built Environment Podcast, featuring exclusive interviews with world-class thought leaders, executives, and civic leaders committed to a better and more beautiful built environment. Established in 1888 and built on a foundation of integrity, trust, and collaboration, our history has prepared us for this moment. Possibility is limited only by our imagination. We know what tomorrow can bring because we've seen thousands of tomorrows and are prepared to shape what comes next. Pride of ownership, peace of mind. Our podcast is hosted by Tom DiOro of The Modern Architect at KZSU at Stanford University. Go to swinnerton.com/podcast.
Thank you, Maggie. For our guest today, let's welcome Elsie Owusu, architect, principal, and specialist conservation architect, interior and urban designer. Elsie is a Ghana-born British architect and founding member and first chair of the Society of Black Architects. She's also known to have co-led the refurbishment of the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom and worked on Green Park Tube Station. She's been elected Royal Institute of British Architects Council member and vice chair of the London School of Architecture. Elsie's passionate about contemporary architecture and city planning, as you'll hear in our interview. And she's particularly fascinated by their relationship to the arts in general and the specific work of individual artists. Elsie's contributed designs for public transportation systems in Lagos, Nigeria, and Accra, Ghana. For more information, feel free to visit owusu.uk. That's owusu.uk. Hello, Elsie. Well, come and thank you so much for being on our show. It's awesome to see you as always.
Hi, Tom. Nice to see you too. And thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real privilege and a pleasure.
Thank you, Elsie. Elsie, as we talked about before we came on the show several times, do you have a particular quote, mantra, prayer that just kind of moves you through the day, personally and professionally?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. And if it's all right, I shall read it to you.
More than all right.
It's quite short. Okay. And it is a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. in 1963 when he was in Birmingham City Jail. And he said, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We're caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." And so that's one of my favorite quotes. Obviously, I don't say the whole thing to myself, but just that first line, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere," is something that echoes through my life and my work.
Wonderful.
And actually, it was one of the quotes which was chosen for the Supreme Court in London when I was working on that project. So it means a lot to me.
Elsie, thank you very much for sharing. It'll segue into your work as an architect, designer, and overview of entire cities and communities. I love you so much of your work, but it seems as if you start with the people first. I know it's a design building and community or structure, but it looks like you design with like the human in mind first. Am I wrong or?
No, okay. No, you're absolutely right. Yes, that is always my starting point is, I mean, it's a human being, whether that those are the people in the team or the people who I know and I hope will enjoy living in the buildings that we make together.
Who inspired you in architecture or design? If you can look back, are there a number of people? And please share if there are a number of people or anyone in particular. Were you?
Well, I mean, I think coming from Ghana, buildings and particular homes have always been as a focal point in our family and in our culture, because people make homes not just in the metaphorical sense, but in the physical sense. Most people in Ghana have family land of some description. And so it is a continuing subject of conversation, what people are going to do with their land, where they're going to live, where they're going to move. And it is a very land-focused and building-focused culture. So I grew up, my step-grandfather was a building contractor, I later discovered. So I think it must have been from very beginning part of my childhood from before I can remember.
That's interesting because it sounds like there's a lineage and even a spiritual connection to land and a place of home for you.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and people talk about land, people talk about home and people talk about land, people talk about making buildings a lot. And it was quite interesting because when I went back to Ghana after years and years and years of being away, I noticed in my grandmother's house that there were certain details, which to me looked almost like a sort of mock Tudor gable end of a building. And so I said to her, why do people make buildings like that? Because I noticed all the way through the town, there were these sort of English details. And she explained that my grandfather had been a main contractor in the town. So I then started noticing that wherever he had built a building, he used a certain detail. And then I began to realize how much of the town he and his company must have built. And then later on, when he died, I discovered that he'd worked on buildings with English architects, Maxwell Fry and Jane Drew. So although I obviously, you know, it was an absolute surprise to me to find these things out,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
it was a great surprise, but it was also just a real pleasure to feel connected to such wonderful work.
And that connection, from what I've seen of your work, what I find is many things fascinating, but one in particular is that there's a great range of your work. It's not just a set style, but there's a range. Is that by design that you have that kind of breadth or diversity of design?
Well, it's interesting because what I discovered when I went back to Ghana after maybe 30 or 40 years was that people just thought that if you were an architect, if you had trained to be an architect, if you had got your qualifications, then they could ask you to build anything. You know, so it started off with an audience with the president who said, I have a project that I want to discuss with you. And we all sort of sat forward in our seats, as you do, if such an auspicious client deigns to talk to you. And he said, yes, I'd like you to consider designing my new presidential residence. And after we picked ourselves up off the floor and practically said, well, Excellency, are you really sure you want to do this? Well, he said, well, you know, I studied in the UK. He was a barrister, trained in the UK. He said, and I know how difficult it must have been for you group of people, we were the society, a delegation from the Society of Black Architects. I understand how difficult it must have been for you to persevere and be resilient and stay in the profession and to be where you are now. So as far as I'm concerned, any commission is worthy. You're worthy of any commission. And I believe that, you know, that you have the skills and the talent to do it. It was interesting that he was holding us up,
yeah,
you know, and boosting our sense of self-worth. And ever since then, I just felt really buoyed up by that, by his confidence and the feeling that as an architect, you have the capacity to design anything that anybody wants you to design.
Excellent. You're listening to the Modern Built Environment Podcast, brought to you by Swinnerton. We're talking today with Elsie Owusu, Principal, EOA Architects. For more information, feel free to visit owusu.uk. That's owusu.uk. Elsie, I love that you talked about the worthy of any project. All clients see the value and your skill set, your expertise, your passion, and your just your personableness? Or is it something that in some ways you have to educate them as to the value as well?
Well, I think that at this great age, that I think I've done enough work for people to understand or have an inkling of what I'm about before they come to me. So when I was a young architect, you did have to go through the sort of the trials and tribulations of establishing a relationship. But now it is pretty much that people know who I am, the work that I've done. And, you know, thanks to Google, people often do the research before they approach you, or they know your building, or they know somebody who knows the building that you've built. So it's much, much easier as a mature architect. I think when you're a young architect, you do have go through the battles with people. Mostly people think that they're buying your skills in order that you do what you're told. You know, I'm paying you. I want a building that looks like my next door neighbors or my cousin in a village somewhere, and I'm or a town somewhere, and I want you to design one of those. Thank you very much. And so one of the most important things that I was taught, one of the first lessons I was taught as a baby architect, was never work for people you don't like, never work for people you don't admire, and always be ready to walk. And there was a lovely story, I'm sure it's apocryphal, about Richard Rogers when he was a baby architect designing the Pompidou Centre. And the story was that he always kept a letter of resignation in his back pocket. You know, so and that's been a really important lesson for me, which is that your life is very precious, your life is very short, and nothing is worth the sacrifice of your skills, your talent, your conscience. So, and I try to instill that in the young architects that I work with.
Wow. At what point did that resonate with you? Was it earlier in your career or as you...
It was kind of the second day at the Architectural Association.
Second day. Wow. So it really resonates with you, obviously.
Yes. There's an English expression. I don't know if you've come across it curmudgeonly.
Yeah, I like that word too. Oh.
So I've been a curmudgeon from a young age, and I don't think I'm going to change anytime soon.
How about your process when you... when you work or you're going to be working with a prospective client or a commission project, can you share with us your vision when you see a project, whatever it is? Do you have a mental checklist that you go through to say, okay, I understand what they're looking to, what their expectations are, and based on what I'm seeing, experiencing, hearing, and thinking about, here's how we can meet that expectation or even exceed it in the time frame and the budget or the commission itself?
Well, I mean, I find that working with clients is a bit like, it must be a bit, I've never been a therapist, but I think it must be a bit like being a therapist. And so the aspiration that people come to you with is quite often not where you end up. And having been through the process numerous times, you kind of know that you're more than likely to end up somewhere different from the place or the space that your clients imagine. So I think the most important thing for architects, the most important part of an architect's anatomy, is our ears. So the capacity to listen, and to listen closely and listen to the messages, which are not necessarily the top line messages, but the third and fourth, maybe fifth line of messages that people are sending you. The body language, if it's a family or a couple, the relationship between the couple, how they speak to each other, the regard that they have for each other, the tensions that there are between them. In the first or the second session, all that comes to the surface. And, you know, then you know that you are somehow going to become part of that dynamic. And you have to very swiftly make a decision about whether you want these people in your life or not. You know, never mind them wanting you in their life. You know, if, for instance, if there's a couple who have a proper tension between them, and the house is, or the building is a focus of that tension, or it's an organization which is going through a transition, and they come to you with a commission that is going to become a big area of contention between them, then it's likely that you and your relationship and your practice might suffer. Or they might come to you and they're just wonderful people and you think, gosh, I'm going to learn so much from these people. We are going to have a blast. This is going to be fantastic. And you pick that up really, really quickly. And then it's either a question of moving forward and guiding people without making them feel patronized, making them feel buoyed up and supported through the process. Because it's very easy. It's such a technical process and it's such a complicated process that quite often people feel intimidated and can feel disempowered by the process. So, you know, you have to judge that very finely and quite quickly create a language of mutuality, a way of sharing ideas, a common language between you. And you have to do that pretty fast so that you can move ahead with the project. I mean, there's a wonderful architect called Cedric Price who said, you know, people will come to you saying they want to build a new extension to their fantastic home because, you know, their granny's getting older and she needs somewhere to live. And you pick up very soon that, you know, he might want his mother to live there, but she met her mother-in-law living in the house. And you might say, well, you know, have you thought of sending your lovely grandmother away for a long holiday in the south of France, for instance? And then, you know, you can save the money on the extension. You can perhaps, you know, buy a farmhouse somewhere that you can, you know, so you kind of work through exactly what it is that they're employing an architect to do. And it might be they're employing an architect as a panacea for a series of problems that they either identify or don't identify. And you very quickly have to assess the situation and see how you can help. And it might not necessarily be through bricks and mortar or making a building.
Fascinating. You're listening to the Modern Built Environment podcast presented by Swinnerton. Our Elsie's charitable contribution service announcement is transplantlinks.org. And what transplantlinks.org does is there's a desperate need for living kidney transplant programs in developing countries. The outlook for someone with kidney failure in many countries is worse than if they had HIV/AIDS. Kidney failure often goes undiagnosed and untreated. The rate of kidney failure is so high, accounting for nearly 10% of hospital admissions in Africa. Yet the only treatment available is dialysis. Many people can't afford dialysis, and in many countries it's unavailable, particularly for children. Patients, therefore, die unnecessarily. For more information, feel free to visit transplantlinks.org. Again, that's transplantlinks.org. We're talking today with Elsie Owusu, Principal EOA Architects. For more information, feel free to visit their website at owusu.uk. Elsie, can you share with us the meaning and why, you know, Transplant Links matters to you?
Well, I was born in Ghana, which used to be called the Gold Coast. And the reason it was called the Gold Coast is because it produced so much of the world's gold. So Ghana still produces 1.5 million ounces of gold per annum. And most of that gold is produced by the informal sector, the informal mining sector, the artisanal miners. And the artisanal miners use a number of toxic substances. They use cyanide and they use mercury. And what happens with mercury is that it can result very quickly in kidney failure. So if you're living on less than a dollar a day and you're using mercury and you're up to your waist in mercury and you're a young person of 8, 9, 10 upwards, you know, the possibility of getting a renal failure is very high. And if you get renal failure and the only option is dialysis, which costs between $50 and $100 a day, you know, your livelihood, your lifespan is likely to be very short. So that's why it's really important that those people who do get kidney disease get treated properly. And the best way of treating kidney disease is through interfamily transplants. So brothers, sisters, aunts, cousins, if we can find a match, then Transplant Links community goes out from the UK to Ghana and to the Caribbean and does those transplants. But it is, even though it's much cheaper than it is in the UK, it's still very expensive. So each trip can cost up to £50,000. The doctors and the nurses give their time for free, but it's still relatively expensive. So I'm a patron of Transplant Links community. I work with artisanal gold miners in Ghana. And we're hoping to hold an auction soon. So if you check on their website, it should be coming up very soon.
Thank you very much, Elsie. Wow, that's very very moving, and looking forward to helping at least spread the message and the importance of this. No, thank you. Thank you
so much. Really appreciate it.
Elsie, what's changed in the last several years for you as an architect, designer, and your passion is city planning as well? What's changed for you in the last several years that you'd love to share with your audience today?
Well, I think the climate emergency has come to the fore and has been recognized at last for what it is, which is, you know, a real challenge to health and well-being. And it's not just a climate emergency, it's a public health emergency, it's a housing emergency. The great movement of people, particularly from sub-Saharan Africa, and the huge lack of housing, that combined with COVID, with the pandemic, and the Black Lives Matter movement, I think has fused to bring a series of concerns to the fore. I mean, in the UK, for instance, people from the Black, Asian, minority ethnic communities suffer disproportionately from the effects of COVID. And that's a combination of many things, including very poor housing provision. And the migration into cities in all over the world is causing a huge emergency. And to me, it seems that there is an opportunity for architects and engineers and technicians, artists, to bring about a different awareness of how we manage this confluence of great challenges that we're facing today.
Excellent. I'll go back to what you had said earlier in your show, is that about life being very precious and finite. Can you share with your audience today how it also relates, obviously, to architecture? You touched on it now, but even go a little deeper as to why that means so much to you.
Well, my beloved mother is 91, and she will she does not like being described as elderly, but I think
that's great.
And she has a wonderful, wonderful memory. And my daughter and I have just been working with her on her life story. So we've been recording a decade of her life at a time. And so we've now got to her seventh decade. And it's been such a wonderful, wonderful experience, because, you know, her long-term memory is absolutely pin sharp. So when you say, you know, and what about 1939? Oh, I remember that very well. She says, that's the year the war started. And of course, that was the year of the earthquake. And she then tells a lovely story. Oh, Uncle Johannes came to see us, you know, and the earthquake started. And he ran down the stairs shouting, fire, fire. And then you get shown a picture of Uncle Johannes in his best bib and tucker, as we say. And it's just been the most wonderful experience. But also, it's a real gift because that, and she wanted to do it because she wanted her children and her great-grandchildren to know her and understand her life. And then, you know, the whole thing about the empire, because, you know, she was born in 1929, when the British Empire was at its zenith. So, you know, on Empire Day, the Empire Day would be a holiday for them. And she learnt songs, she learnt English songs, she learnt songs in her own language, but primarily she learnt about the mother country and how important the mother country was. So, and of course with Black Lives Matter, that's become a big talking point in the UK. But to hear another side of it, which isn't binary, you know, it wasn't this or that. It was so many shades and so many colours and so many aspects. And to hear that brought to life, and the songs and the poems and the little anecdotes, just fantastic. So that made me understand, really, the span of my mother's life from 1929 to 2021, nearly, just how short and how precious life is.
Elsie, it's been an absolute honor and joy having you on our show. I hope you consider coming back again soon. This is really wonderful. I could talk to you for much longer. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Modern Built Environment podcast brought to you by Swinerton. You can find us online at swinerton.com/podcast. Our guest today has been Elsie Owusu, architect, principal, and specialist conservation architect, interior, and urban designer. Elsie was born in Ghana. She's Ghana-born British architect and founding member and first chair of the Society of Black Architects. She's also known to have co-led the refurbishment of the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom and worked on the Green Park Tube Station. She's also been elected Royal Institute of British Architects Council member and vice chair of the London School of Architect. Elsie's passionate about contemporary architecture and city planning. She's particularly fascinated by the relationships to the arts in general and the specific work of individual artists. Elsie's completed designs for public transportation systems in Lagos, Nigeria, and Ghana. For more information, feel free to visit her website at owusu.uk. That's owusu.uk. Please join us again next time when we welcome another leading architect, engineer, builder, manufacturer, or civic leader committed to building a better and more beautiful built environment for healthier cities, communities, and lives. I'm Tom Dior.
The Modern Built Environment podcast is recorded at the Swinerton headquarters and on location. The recording engineer is Stephen Blatton. The executive producer and host of the Modern Built Environment podcast is Tom Dioro. And we're all assisted by Mr. Eric Foster. This is the Modern Built Environment podcast by Swinerton.